Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 366, What's Going On Here?, being recorded on June 30th of 2002. And we're going to continue with our eco-political, geopolitical, and military analysis of September 11th as an extension of World War II, literally a war between the Underground Reich and its Islamo-fascist allies and its fifth column in the United States, political, economic, and probably within the military. And this is quite simply a struggle for the future of civilization. And if that sounds melodramatic, well, it is a very serious state of affairs indeed. Returning to our discussion, I've heard a lot of analysis of September 11th that has been, frankly, either incomplete or completely inadequate. In the next broadcast, we're going to get into some of the countercultural aspects and some of the psychological warfare aspects of September 11th, including the role that conspiracy theory, so to speak, has played in some of the misinformation or disinformation being spread about September 11th. It was really a conspiracy by Jewish space aliens and this and that. I'm exaggerating only slightly because I've heard a lot of real crazy stuff about September 11th. But we're going to talk about that, and perhaps time permitting, we're going to conclude today's discussion with an excerpt from Sun Tzu's Art of War that will address that. But in terms of understanding how inadequate the concept of the government is, it's rather like children or adolescents talking about the grown-ups. If they were asking about September 11th, would they say, well, it was the grown-ups, wasn't it? Well, there really is no such thing as the grown-ups per se. There are various elements of what are theoretically grown-ups. But in terms of understanding the government did it, I think a very intelligent insight about the nature of government was stated by James Stewart Martin in the book that we were reading from in the first half of the broadcast. That book is called All Honorable Men, published in hardcover by Little Brown and Company and published in 1950. James Stewart Martin, in charge of the economic warfare section of the Department of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice in World War II, and he wrote his account of his unsuccessful attempts at German decartelization and of breaking up this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. In Chapter 20, James Stewart Martin writes as follows, and in terms of understanding, well, it was the government, this is what one should understand. After 2.5 years, I came back from Germany quite well aware that I had been wrestling with a buzzsaw. We had not been stopped in Germany by German business, we had been stopped in Germany by American business. The forces that had stopped us had operated from the United States, but had not operated in the open. We were not stopped by a law of Congress, by an executive order of the President, or even by a change of policy approved by the President or any member of his cabinet. In short, whatever it was that had stopped us was not the government, unquote, but it clearly had command of channels through which the government normally operates. In the United States in 1933, President Roosevelt tried to establish a government powerful enough to talk back to the private operators. For a time, the Roosevelt government asserted its right to control business activities wherever they might affect the public interest. But with the outbreak of war, men who had been on the outside during this New Deal era cursing that man from their chairs in the Union League Club had to be called to Washington. So in terms of understanding whether it was the government, quote unquote, it's not that simple. We've spoken in the past about the Borman Organization, the definitive text, of course, about that we've used many times. Authored by Paul Manning, it's called Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981 by the Manning family. Paul Manning was part of the Edward R. Murrow team that covered World War II for CBS News, flew combat missions as a gunner, both on B-17s into Europe and in B-29s to cover the raids in Japan, and broadcast the surrender of Germany and the surrender of Japan in World War II on the CBS radio network. And in terms of analyzing the channels of power that the Borman Organization ultimately drew on, and I believe that we are seeing a struggle by the Borman Organization to conquer the world, including twisting the arm of their American former American consorts to basically accept a minority role in this geopolitical struggle. Bear in mind, these same forces maintained relationships before, during, and after World War II, and yet the war itself was a very real one. That is analogous. The Treasury Department operation to interdict the Borman Organization was called Operation Safe Haven, and we're going to read about one of the Safe Haven operatives, Orvis A. Schmidt, and we're also going to excerpt his testimony before a congressional committee. Turning to Martin Borman, Nazi in exile. Even today, however, there are U.S. Treasury old-timers of World War II still not aware of the magnitude of the Borman operation and of its success. Those who know in Washington and South America and in the capitals of Europe are locked together in a conspiracy of silence that has endured for 37 years until the publication of this book. In this silent contest during the wind-down years of World War II, Orvis A. Schmidt was not to emerge victor over Martin Borman, although he tried. Tirelessly, he told assorted Senate committees what was happening, spoke of the extent of the German plan, and urged a new dedication to stopping the flight capital blitzkrieg with the prescient warning, quote, "It is these new concentrations of economic power which will enable Germany to rise again," unquote. Orvis A. Schmidt felt that he was a man crying in the wilderness as he gave testimony before Senate committees. The mood of the country and the marketplace was similar. Get our boys home and get on with the business of making money and building new homes and stabilizing the economy for the bumper crop of babies which was sure to come. When Orvis Schmidt told the senators the extent of German economic infiltration into the foreign countries even before VE Day, and that the Germans intended to preserve this vast hidden economic structure in order to rise again, he knew instinctively that he had failed to catch the interest of the American lawmakers. Schmidt testified, "The danger does not lie so much in the fact that the German industrial giants have honeycombed the neutrals, Turkey and Argentina, with branches and affiliates which know how to subvert their commercial interests to the espionage and sabotage demands of their government. It is important and dangerous, however, that many of these branches, subsidiaries, and affiliates in the neutrals, and much of the cash, securities, patents, contracts, and so forth, are ostensibly owned through the medium of secret numbered accounts, or rubric accounts, trusts, loans, holding companies, bearer shares, and the like, by dummy persons and companies claiming neutral nationality, and all of the alleged protection and privileges arising from such identities. The real problem is to break the veil of secrecy and reach and eliminate the German ability to finance another world war. We must render useless the devices and cloaks which have been employed to hide German assets." And again, that is the testimony of Orvis A. Schmidt before the Senate. We're going to turn now to something that we looked at before in discussing President Roosevelt's unsuccessful attempts at limiting commercial power. We're going to turn to the book, The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by the heroic John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, published in hardcover and softcover by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. The ISBN number for the softcover edition, 0-312-15-6480-0. And as we've looked at in the past, one of the key American branches of what James Stuart Martin called the fraternity were the Harriman 15 companies, the Hamburg American Line, the Union Banking Corporation, and other commercial entities associated with the Bush family and through the Thiessens. They were very closely associated not only with the Third Reich, but also with the Borman Organization. The Sullivan and Cromwell Law Firm was instrumental in helping to set up many of these arrangements, as we looked at, and among other programs, For the Record 361. And Alan Dulles was one of the key people involved in helping to interdict Operation Safe Haven. As we took a look at in For the Record 346, and I'm going to review briefly now, President Roosevelt had made provisions to use the Operation Safe Haven documents to not only indict German industrialists, but through that to indict some of their American and British counterparts for war crimes. Had he lived, not only people like Alan Dulles, but also people like George W. Bush's grandfather and great-grandfather would have been in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg. Turning to the secret war against the Jews, all through the war, Roosevelt had reluctantly caved in to British demands that the Jewish issue be ignored, that the concentration camp victims must be expendable to the war effort. But the one issue upon which Roosevelt was unyielding was his insistence that after the war, the German bankers must stand in the dock at the Nuremberg war crimes trial. This is confirmed by the top-secret White House Justice Department correspondence files. The plan was to wait until Obbs, Krupp, Flick, and the rest of the industrialists were charged. Then, Morgenthau would unleash the wiretap evidence, that's former Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau, then Morgenthau would unleash the wiretap evidence showing that the Nazis had hidden their stolen assets in Switzerland with the help of Alan Dulles. The whole scandal of Western aid to the German economy would unravel, all the slights of the Standard Oil blackmail would be avenged. The sudden release of the safe haven intercepts would force a public outcry to bring treason charges against those British and American businessmen who aided the enemy in time of war. The targets included not only the Dulles brothers, but Forrestal and major industrialists such as Henry Ford. From a prosecutor's point of view, indicting the German bankers first was a brilliant strategy. To save themselves, Hermann Abbs and Hjalmar Schacht, the former Nazi finance minister, would have to reveal the whole history of their sordid dealings with companies such as Ford Motor. Despite the shields of Swiss banking laws and the layers of corporations that Dulles had erected, he had never anticipated that the Swiss bank codes and cables would ever become public knowledge. Roosevelt and Morgenthau would have hanged him and all of his colleagues for ever breaking the power of the pirates of international finance. It was a glorious dream, yet the scheme completely fell apart because someone tipped off Dulles that he was under surveillance, skipping down. Because he learned about the safe haven intercept so quickly, Dulles knew there was no smoking gun against him. His work for the Nazis prior to the war was not illegal, let alone treasonous. His wartime communications with the Nazis, although highly embarrassing, could be excused as an exercise in deception or as part of his intrigues to overthrow Hitler. Although many of his wartime actions were unauthorized, they were not criminal. What was criminal was the way that Dulles was trying to help the German industrialists get their money out at the end of the war. After the Nazis' 1943 defeat at Stalingrad, various Nazi businessmen realized they were on the losing side and made plans to evacuate their wealth. The Perón government in Argentina was receiving the Nazi flight capital with open arms, and Dulles helped it hide the money. This was more than a violation of the Trading with the Enemy Act. Giving aid and comfort to the enemy in time of war was treason. Once again, however, Alan Dulles was one step ahead of his pursuers. And the interdiction of safe haven, after, of course, President Roosevelt died, he was succeeded by Truman, skipping ahead in secret war against the Jews. Dulles and some of his friends volunteered for post-war service with the government not out of patriotism but out of necessity. They had to be in positions of power to suppress the evidence of their own dealings with the Nazis. The safe haven investigation was quickly stripped from Treasury, where Morgenthau's supporters were still influential, and turned over to the State Department. There, Dulles' friends shredded the index to the interlocking corporations and blocked further investigations. Dulles had this goal in mind. Not a single American businessman was ever going to be convicted of treason for helping the Nazis. None ever was, despite the evidence. According to one of our sources in the intelligence community, the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps had two large civilian internment centers in occupied Germany, codenamed Ashcan and Dustbin, unquote. The Counterintelligence Corps had identified and captured a large number of U.S. citizens who had stayed in Germany and aided the Third Reich all through World War II. The evidence of their treason was overwhelming. The captured German records were horribly incriminating. Yet Victor Warahida, the young Justice Department attorney responsible for preparing the treason trials, suddenly ordered the prisoners' release. All of the Nazi collaborators were allowed to return to the United States and reclaim their citizenship. At the same time, another Justice Department attorney, O. John Rogge, who dared to make a speech about Nazi collaborators in the United States, was quickly fired. However, the attorney who buried the treason cases was later promoted to Special Assistant Attorney General. Dulles and his Nazi clients had won. Bear in mind that after the 1948 election, when Truman narrowly defeated Dewey, Alan Dulles and his protege Richard Nixon worked to bring Nazi collaborators and Nazi war criminals, including at least one SS intelligence unit, the Vorkommando Moscow, to the United States in order to help counteract, quote, Jewish influence, unquote. They ultimately coalesced into the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization. This organization was called the Crusade for Freedom. Its front man was Ronald Reagan. The person who handled the State Department machinations to bring these people into the country was William Casey, who managed the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980 and then became director of the CIA. One of the areas where Truman departed from Roosevelt was in his friendly neutralism towards the Arabs and consequently his opposition to the creation of the State of Israel. And I believe that some of the threads that wind through the contemporary conflict can be traced back to this period of time. To the utter dismay of the Pirates of Wall Street and their friends in the Truman administration, the new president dismissed these scare tactics. Worse, he reversed the commitments that Roosevelt had made to King Ibn Saud. By the way, the scare tactics refers to alarmism about Israel becoming an ally of the Soviet Union. Beginning again worse, he reversed the commitments that Roosevelt made to Ibn Saud. Truman had more regard for the probable influence of the American Jewish community on his reelection prospects than he did for the anti-Semites of the State Department. 6 months into his presidency, Truman assembled his top Middle East advisors, who were deeply concerned at the Arabs' hostility toward the new president's pro-Zionist tilt. As hard as they tried, they could not bring him around. Harry Truman did not want to be a one-term, unelected president. He wanted to win the 1948 election and claim the mantle in his own right. Even in 1945, Truman knew there might be just enough Jews in the United States to tip the 1948 election, while Arabs were a negligible electoral quantity. Roosevelt's policy of neutrality in favor of the Arabs was dead, at least as far as the new president was concerned. By the way, and for the records, 353, 356, and 359, I speculated that the importation of Wahhabi elements and their inclusion, including Islamo-fascist elements connected to the Al-Taqwa milieu, and their inclusion in the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization might very well be an extension of the Crusade for Freedom dynamic, sort of a jihad for freedom, intended to once again counteract the, quote, Jewish vote, unquote. Now, keep in mind the concept of networking. Keep in mind the relationship between Alan Dulles and people like King Ibn Saud. And keep in mind also François Janoux, a key Third Reich spy, a key Third Reich underground operative, and a key post-war financier and operative of international terrorism. His name has cropped up in connection with the September 11th investigation in a number of different contexts, alleged to be the founder of Al-Taqwa by an article in the Chronicle. San Francisco Chronicle, alleged by Ernest Bacchus to have set up fronts in Switzerland, financial fronts that the Bacchus believes were involved in the funding of September 11th. A Janoux protege, Jacques Vergès, is the law partner of Isabelle Couton-Père, the future wife of Carlos the Jackal and the French attorney for accused 20th hijacker Zacharias Moussaoui. Now, bear in mind that Janoux was a key post-war operative dispensing Nazi monies, thereby inevitably involved with the Bormann organization. Janoux, too, is part of the same milieu. François Janoux, as I like to say, had more connections than a switchboard. Among his connections were to former SS General Karl Wolff, who in turn helped to negotiate the surrender of the SS forces in Italy to Alan Dulles. Another of Janoux's his associates was the aforementioned Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, a Third Reich finance minister and a key player in Nazi finance before, during, and after World War II. Of Janoux, his connections to Karl Wolff, Alan Dulles, and the Sunrise Milieu, and to Hjalmar Schacht, we read as follows. In the remarkable text, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International, an essential book for understanding international fascism and the post-war fascist international in particular. The book was copyrighted 1999 in softcover by autonomedia.org and, of course, was written by Kevin Coogan, C-O-O-G-A-N. The Genou Wolf, Sunrise Dulles, and in turn Genou Hjalmar Schacht milieu discussed as follows. Genou, too, was in the thick of things, having established a friendship with SS General Karl Wolff, leader of the German team in Italy that negotiated Operation Sunrise with Alan Dulles. Shortly after the war, Genou acquired the publishing rights to the works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. He also played a major, if murky, role in aging fugitive Nazi war criminals. Skipping down. In 1955, with the Grand Mufti's friend Johann von Leers helping to run Egypt's propaganda ministry and its all-important Institute for the Study of Zionism, unquote, Genou began to see Egypt as a base for the anti-French FLN independence movement in Algeria. Bear in mind that one of Johann von Leers' protégés was Ahmed Huber, a key member of the board of directors of Al-Taqwa/Nahda Management. Continuing. Speaking of Genou, he worked in Tangier with an ex-SS officer named Hans Reichenberg to create the Arabo-Africa Import-Export Company, which supplied the FLN with weapons. Arabo-Africa was actually a cover enterprise established by Werner Naumann's network and included Genou's friend, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht. Again, the key term here is networking. We're going to take a look right now at an interesting element, which we'll look ahead to some of our lines of inquiry next week. One of the key U.S. intelligence officials involved with the coordination with the Underground Reich and the bringing of many of these war criminals and fascists into the U.S. intelligence system was Frank Wisner, a deputy director of the CIA and head of the Office of Policy Coordination. Frank Wisner was also an attorney with the Carter Ledyard Milburn Wall Street law firm. In 1964, shortly after the assassination of President Kennedy, Frank Wisner committed suicide. He'd had a number of psychological problems, but what's very interesting is one of the things that was apparently bothering him around the time of his death. We're going to turn to one of the seminal texts about the assassination of President Kennedy. This is called The Man Who Knew Too Much. It was authored by Dick Russell, published in hard and soft cover by Carroll and Graff Publishers, copyright 1992, the ISBN number 0-88184-900-6. And what do you think was on Frank Wisner's mind at the time of his death? Well, we're going to find out right now. Another figure who ended up deeply tormented was Frank Wisner, the CIA's original man in charge of bringing over the Nazi scientists under paperclip and with establishing the Galen, Ukrainian, and White Russian underground movements in Europe. In 1961, after suffering two nervous breakdowns in recent years, Wisner left the CIA but kept his interest in agency affairs. Apparently, sometime not long after the Kennedy assassination, as Wisner's daughter Wendy recalled to author Burton Hirsch, her father became obsessed with the world he had been so enmeshed in creating. Wisner began talking about his belief that Martin Bormann, Hitler's leading henchman, had escaped Berlin at the end of the war and resettled in Latin America. "He was on a thing about this," Hirsch quotes Wendy Wisner in his 1992 book, The Old Boys, "that we should pool our sources and resources and get Bormann." He talked about the mysterious and sinister figure of Martin Bormann. He wrote millions of letters. If there really was a CIA connection to Bormann in South America, who knows if he wasn't feeling terrible about it? If he's starting to yell and scream about these Nazis, who in the CIA is starting to get worried about it? Unquote. On October 29th, 1965, Frank Wisner put a 20-gauge shotgun to his head and pulled the trigger. One wonders, was he programmed to do that? Was it really a suicide? Very interesting that near the time of his death, Frank Wisner was becoming concerned about Martin Bormann. Again, I believe that the pendulum has swung back the other way, and I believe that right now the U.S. and the rest of the civilized world is in a life-and-death struggle with the Underground Reich and its Islamo-fascist allies. Looking ahead to next week's show, we're going to talk about some of the psychological and political/theoretical aspects to September 11th, including the role conspiracy theories have made in helping to obfuscate the truth, and also serving as propaganda to dismiss some of the darker aspects of this very dark event. Interestingly enough, bearing in mind the role of the Galen Organization and also later the U.S.'s Islamo-fascist allies who fought against the Soviet Union, both ultimately serving as Trojan horses against the United States, we're going to turn to an interesting excerpt from Sun Tzu's The Art of War. This, in turn, was quoted in the book The Service, the memoirs of General Reinhard Galen, published in hardcover by World Publishing, and copyright 1972. The hardcover ISBN number 0-529-04455-2. Now, Galen here is talking about Sun Tzu and his recitation of psychological warfare. Of course, he attributes this to what the communists were going to do. Just imagine this as being what Galen, Bormann, the Mueller Organization, and their underground Reich allies all around the world, and imagine if they were going to destroy the United States. Try this out. There is no art higher than that of destroying the enemy's resistance without a fight on the battlefield. The direct tactic of war is necessary only on the battlefield, but only the indirect tactic can lead to a real and lasting victory. Subvert anything of value in the enemy's country. Implicate the emissaries of the major powers in criminal undertakings, undermine their position, and destroy their reputation in other ways as well, and expose them to the public ridicule of their fellow citizens. Do not shun the aid of even the lowest and most despicable people. Disrupt the work of their government with every means you can. Spread disunity and dispute among the citizens of the enemy's country. Turn the young against the old. Use every means to destroy their arms, their supplies, and the discipline of the enemy's forces. Debase old traditions and accepted gods. Be generous with promises and rewards to purchase intelligence and accomplices. Send out your secret agents in all directions. Do not skimp with money or with promises, for they yield a high return. Keep that in mind. And keep in mind also the very end of James Stuart Martin's All Honorable Men. The moral of this is not that Germany is an inevitable menace, but that there are forces in our own country which can make Germany a menace. And more importantly, they could create a menace of their own here at home, not through a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but as a calm judgment of business necessity, unquote. The men who would do this are not Nazis, but businessmen. Not criminals, but honorable men. Unquote. And again, bearing in mind networking and the ties that bond, I believe that there was and is a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but that is being executed by the Underground Reich. Should the United States go bankrupt or be otherwise placed into a situation where fascism becomes a calm judgment of business necessity, then we will find ourselves in the position that Sun Tzu advocated that a victim country should be in. This concludes For the Record 366, being recorded on June 30th of 2002. It's called What's Going On Here? My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.